This is the NPR News Update. Minnesota's news on your schedule. It's Friday, May 3rd. I'm John Wanamaker. A bill that would allow daycare providers and personal care assistants with state-subsidized clients to hold a vote to form a union appears headed for a vote on the House floor after clearing its final committee yesterday. Supporters say a union could help increase daycare subsidies and give providers a unified voice at the Capitol. Critics say collective bargaining would drive up daycare costs for parents. Mark Zedeklik reports.
On St. Paul's east side, a dozen or so kids play outside at Mary Albert's daycare.
And this is our slide. See the children having fun sliding.
It's a beautiful spring day, and everyone's having a blast.
Don't get on his back like that. Go on down, honey.
The Minnesota Child Care Assistance Program foots the daycare bill for some of the kids playing here. A union, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, AFSCME, wants to unionize providers like Mary Albert. In exchange for union dues, AFSCME says daycare providers could get better continuing education and solid representation at the state capitol. Eric Lato is with AFSCME Council 5, which has been trying to organize Minnesota daycare providers for several years.
Child care providers in other states have organized and done a whole bunch of variety of different things, from including to increasing the overall child care subsidy rates. It will give them opportunities to have better opportunities for support, which would professionalize their system or their profession.
Therese, can you show me how to jump rope?
Mary Albert says she and some other providers have gathered as an informal union for several years. She says they've even gone to the legislature to lobby. Albert says they're all convinced that the clout of AFSCME would benefit them as lawmakers set subsidy rates and daycare rules.
We just want a voice at the table when they're making rules and regulations.
Eric Lato from AFSCME insists the union is seeking only to organize providers with state-subsidized kids, and that the effort is not part of a larger plan to organize and collect dues from all daycare providers in Minnesota.
We are not pursuing those providers at this moment. If those providers want to organize in the future, that's really up to them.
Still, many in the daycare business think the union has much broader ambitions. Pam Riley provides before and after school daycare at her home in Oakdale. Riley does not have any state-subsidized kids. She says AFSCME representatives have repeatedly stopped by, promoting unionization and telling her that they want to start with subsidized providers, but the goal is to eventually include everyone.
That's what they told me. And then they passed out like T-shirts and stuff, you know, and trying to get support.
Riley sees no value in unionizing. She says union dues would just be another expense, and she's not alone. The Minnesota Licensed Family Child Care Association says a survey it conducted in March found an overwhelming majority of licensed family child care providers in Minnesota oppose the effort.
Let's get ready for Mrs. Damian. Should we put that book up?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Back in St. Paul, but at a different home daycare, the toddlers that Mary Kazak looks after are doing yoga with the help of an outside instructor who stopped by.
Good job. One more.
Can you do that?
Oh, you guys have the best fire breath ever.
Kazak has been providing daycare for 39 years. Her home is filled with toys and children's furniture and books, as well as with volumes of childcare curricula and training materials. She's involved with several daycare organizations. Some are neutral on the union issue. Because of that, she speaks for herself. She has had state-subsidized kids and could again, but she doesn't have any right now. Kazak, too, is convinced AFSCME wants to represent all daycare providers. She says union dues would drive up the cost of care and that she and other providers don't need a union to train them and advocate for them.
And I don't see a reason for it. We have a great system already going with family child care. We have a lot of training. And the biggest thing is that I don't want them doing their talking for us.
If state lawmakers approve a unionization vote, only providers who currently have state-subsidized kids would be eligible to participate.
That's reporter Mark Zedeklik. Northern Minnesota's timber industry took another blow this week when the Boise Paper Mill in International Falls announced plans to cut 265 jobs and shut down two of its four papermaking machines. As Tom Robertson reports, it's devastating news for the small town of International Falls and for loggers all across the region.
Boise reported a $1.2 million loss in the first 3 months of the year. Company officials blame it on the growing popularity of computers, e-readers, and other electronic devices, which have slashed demand for paper. Lori Lyman is public affairs manager at Boise and International Falls.
It is the right decision for the future of our mill. We have to evolve to meet the challenges that face our industry, and we all know what electronic substitution has done to the paper market, and that's the real driver behind the decline.
Boise officials say the decision to shut down two papermaking machines will allow the plant to run more efficiently. It will mean the plant in International Falls will reduce its production of white business paper by about 9%. They say the downsizing will allow the company to keep 580 employees at the mill. The job cuts are the latest in a string of bad news for the paper industry. A few months ago, the Wisconsin-based Wausau Paper Company announced it was closing its Brainerd mill and eliminating about 130 jobs. Last year, the Verso Paper Mill in Sartell was shuttered following a deadly Memorial Day fire. Since 2000, the paper manufacturing industry in Minnesota has cut some 5,000 jobs, or about one-third. In International Falls, Boise is the largest employer and the economic lifeblood of the town. Paul Nevinen is director of Coochaching County's Economic Development Authority. Nevinen says everyone in town will feel the effects of the job cuts.
You know, this is the reality of our times, and it's, you know, you can't take anything for granted. When it hits home like this and affects the neighbors and friends to the extent that this is going to, it's really devastating.
Nevinen says there aren't many other employment options in the community. That means the people who are losing their jobs may have to move somewhere else. That's tough for a region that already struggles with an aging, dwindling population.
We don't have the diversification that other areas have in terms of major employers and even beyond the timber and tourism industries. So, yeah, there won't be a lot of opportunities, and especially at the pay rates that these folks were. You know, Boise always has paid very strong wage and benefit packages.
The ripple effect will be felt far beyond the International Falls city limits. Loggers from throughout the region count on Boise to buy their timber at a time when demand for wood has been flagging. In 2008, the Canada-based Ainsworth Lumber Company permanently closed three board manufacturing mills in Bemidji, Grand Rapids, and Cook. As of March, Minnesota's wood products industry has lost 6,300 jobs from the peak in 2004. David Haley owns a logging company in Big Fork. While Haley says most of his business is with the Blandin Paper Mill in Grand Rapids, he knows that lots of loggers will feel the pinch from the retrenchment at Boise. Haley says it comes at a time when many loggers can't afford any more bad news.
The board market is one that was really hurt by the housing market crash, and the paper market kind of held steady. It was the one market that guys could kind of count on, was somewhat stable, and now seeing that the paper market is now not as stable or financially secure anymore, I mean, it was that one last glimmer of hope we had, and now it's that's also showing that it is susceptible.
Boise officials say the downsizing won't happen until October. They plan to meet with union officials to discuss severance packages for salaried employees. Tom Robertson, Minnesota Public Radio News, Bemidji.
Two bills that would help Rochester and its flagship employer, Mayo Clinic, expand are making their way through the Minnesota legislature this session. Some lawmakers and Rochester residents say they were caught by surprise when clinic officials announced the multi-billion-dollar expansion proposal known as Destination Medical Center in January. Elizabeth Baer reports on how the clinic rolled out its plan and who knew what and when.
Mayo's proposed multi-billion-dollar expansion plan came to life at what you might call a power lunch in Washington, D.C. in 2007. The informal meeting brought together three of Rochester's top players: Mayo's Rochester CEO, the general manager of the Kaler Hotel, and John Wade, president of the Chamber of Commerce.
Two different efforts were happening at the same time, not known to the other.
Mayo leaders were talking about how the campus should continue to grow, And Wade says Rochester business leaders were trying to figure out how to create a better experience for visitors and patients by improving the city's hospitality industry.
And we talked about the experiences that patients have here. And we talked about hope, and we talked about health, and we talked about hospitality. And ultimately, many of those same themes would be included broadly in the Destination Medical Center initiative.
Mayo's Destination Medical Center Administrator Lisa Clark says 2 years after that lunch, Mayo created a working group of about 30 community leaders to help create a framework for its Destination Medical Community proposal.
It had for-profits, not-for-profits. It had city, community leaders.
The list also included Rochester Mayor Ardell Brady and Assistant City Administrator Gary Newman, downtown business owners, and representatives from the local newspaper and television station.
We had focus groups. We had opportunities for the community to weigh in. We've had brown bag sessions. This is before and after we publicly announced it. So if there was any question about whether or not the community is involved, from the start, the goal was to involve the community.
Mayo's planning meetings were open to certain organizations and community leaders, but not to the general public. And now, some people like Olmsted County District Court Judge Kevin Lund say Mayo took too long to engage all the city's residents in the conversation.
I think the first time I heard about it was probably the first time that the majority of people in the community heard about it, when it was going to be voted on as part of the half-cent sales tax extension.
Last year, Rochester voters approved an extension of the local sales tax that included a $20 million city contribution to pay for improvements that would support Mayo's growth. But at the time, voters didn't know that contribution would be part of a much larger investment plan that was rolled out at the state capitol in January.
I think the troubling aspect for me and for many in the community was, why wasn't the community told about this larger initiative that was obviously part of this $20 million? Why weren't we told that from the beginning?
Others like interim city council president Randy Staver, who support Mayo's expansion plan, concede they didn't know details about the clinic's request to the state until just before it was introduced.
We were introduced to the legislation literally a few days ahead of its introduction, and so we had some opportunity to at least preview it and just be prepared that it's coming, and that was it.
Mayo's Lisa Clark says the financing plan for the clinic expansion only started to take shape about a year ago. And the chamber's John Wade downplays the concerns from some residents who say details about the project's financing should have been made public sooner.
I think it's important to always recall that this was a private sector-led, private sector-driven initiative. It is not a private enterprise's primary responsibility to share everything they do from a business perspective.
Wade says the right people knew at the right time to present the project in the best light. And since announcing the request at the Capitol in January, he says Mayo has pushed to get the message out to as many people as possible at town hall meetings and forums throughout the region. Elizabeth Baer, Minnesota Public Radio News, Rochester.
This is the NPR News Update. We come your way every day around noon. It's Minnesota's news on your schedule. State officials say construction of the St. Croix Bridge will resume today after the discovery of zebra mussels halted work. Rupa Shinoy reports.
MnDOT spokesman Kevin Gutnicht says a Wisconsin contractor trucked in 8 barges.
We had put one barge in the water. We were doing inspections on the other barges, discovered that there was evidence of zebra mussels. We then pulled that other barge out of the water.
Zebra mussels are an invasive species that attach to the hulls of boats. Gutnicht says the contractor will improve its decontamination procedures and the incident won't affect the bridge construction schedule. The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources says the river was never at risk because the zebra mussels were dead.
That's reporter Rupa Shinoy. Minnesota Orchestra music director Osmo Vanska has told the orchestra he will resign if the musician lockout isn't resolved. Chris Roberts has more.
In a letter to Orchestra Board Chair John Campbell and President Michael Henson sent earlier this week, Vanska said he will resign if the lockout isn't settled by September. Vanska said the orchestra needs to be rehearsing by early September to have enough time to prepare for an appearance at New York's Carnegie Hall in November. He called the Carnegie Hall performance one of the most significant goals of his tenure. Vanska said the orchestra also needs to be playing again to get ready for a fall recording commitment. In the letter, he lamented the possible departure of principal clarinetist Bert Hara, who reportedly won an audition at the L.A. Philharmonic, and referred to other musicians who are contemplating leaving. Chris Roberts, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
And some big news for one of the Twin Cities' major sports franchises. David Kahn is out as president of basketball operations for the Minnesota Timberwolves, and Flip Saunders is coming in. Three people with knowledge of the situation say that owner Glenn Taylor is putting the finishing touches on a deal to hire Saunders as Kahn's replacement. The Dorothy Day Center in St. Paul is likely to see some changes. City officials and Dorothy Day leaders say the homeless shelter is overcrowded and unable to effectively serve its clients. St. Paul Mayor Chris Coleman has launched a task force to consider future possibilities and funding options. Julie Seipel reports that task force also will be looking for a new way to carry out its mission.
Visit Dorothy Day at 10 p.m. and you'll see the old model. In a packed room, 100 people lie on mats, each just inches from the next. Most sleep in their clothes, their belongings stashed nearby. The lights are out, but it's not quiet.
No talking, it's lights out, please.
64-year-old Douglas Forsberg has slept on this floor most every night for 4 years.
It's not comfortable. You have no privacy, but it beats sleeping outside. It beats sleeping, you know, under a bridge.
Tim Marks is CEO of Catholic Charities, which runs Dorothy Day. He says that's not good enough.
We simply can't house people as we are now in an undignified, inhumane way and say we're just going to continue on and do the same thing the next year.
In fact, Dorothy Day wasn't intended to be a homeless shelter. When it opened in downtown St. Paul 32 years ago, Dorothy Day was a place for people to get a cup of coffee and some food. Today, up to 250 people a night sleep there, a growing number of them seniors. More and more people come through the door with mental health issues or physical disabilities. Mark says it's become a place people go just to survive another day.
Right now, unfortunately, we are doing too much of managing homelessness and managing crises, just keeping people alive, rather than solving homelessness and solving poverty.
The new Dorothy Day Center Task Force is charged with working out the future of the center. It could move to a new location or stay where it is. Task Force leaders won't talk about funding yet. But Catholic Charities CEO Mark says there is a new model for getting people out of homelessness, and it's right across the river in Minneapolis.
Right now we're standing in the lobby of Higher Ground.
Higher Ground is that new model. It's a 7-story building that has shelter on the first 2 floors and permanent housing on the rest. About a year ago, Catholic Charities closed a shelter in Minneapolis similar to Dorothy Day and replaced it with Higher Ground. It cost $18 million to build. Most of the money came from the state, county, and city, as well as funds from Catholic Charities. John Petroskis works with clients at Higher Ground. He says it's nothing like the shelters with mats on the floor.
We have a lot more space, a lot more light, and we have bunks.
And Higher Ground offers people a chance to move up.
Second floor.
On the second floor, clients pay $7 a night for a bed in what looks like a big dorm. They build up rental history, which many don't have, and the shelter returns their money to use for a damage deposit when they get a place. The men also get lockers, and that really matters, says Petroskis.
Looking homeless is a huge disadvantage to finding work. So if you don't have to carry a huge bag of your stuff, more likely that you'll be able to find a job.
But according to Petroskis, the biggest difference for clients at Higher Ground may be knowing that there's permanent housing above them. That's where there are small rooms with shared kitchens and some efficiencies. That housing is exclusively for people who have been homeless for a long time and have disabilities. But Petroskis says having the different options under one roof gives people hope.
The transition from being homeless and living in a homeless shelter to having a place to live is an easier one for some of our guests to make if it just requires getting on an elevator and going from the shelter to the new place that they're going to live.
Arnold Mercier hopes he'll make that transition someday. He's 50 years old and has been homeless on and off for 10 years. He says staying at Higher Ground has helped him.
It just keeps your spirits up. That you know that you come back here and go, okay, well, I have a safe, secure place. My stuff is secure. You know, it's just peace of mind.
When he talks about the future, he talks about moving to the top floor of higher ground.
Actually gives you that hope and that, you know, bright outlook that, hey, I can get upstairs and I can get my own place.
Higher ground isn't quite a year old yet, but housing advocates say early signs suggest it is moving people out of homelessness. Julie Seipel, Minnesota Public Radio News.
And that's the NPR News Update for Friday, May 3rd. I'm John Wanamaker. Thanks for listening.